health? Do you plan to keep working? If so, how much will you make? At what age did your parents die? How old is your spouse? Is she working? Then it would be possible to give some sensible advice, and possibly even a default option. Hint to financial service companies. Build such a calculator and put it on your website. Saving for retirement is something that humans find difficult. They have to solve a complicated mathematical problem to know how much to save, and then they have to exert a lot of willpower for a long time to execute this plan. This is an ideal domain for nudging. In an environment in which people have to make only one decision per lifetime, we should surely try harder to help them get it right. Chapter 7. Naive Investing. We have been exploring the first part of saving for retirement, joining a plan, and deciding how much to invest. We now turn to the all-important second part, how to invest the money. Once again, the switch from defined benefit to defined contribution plans has given employees more control, more options, and more responsibility. Although solving the problem of how much to save is hard, choosing the right portfolio is even harder. In fact, in an effort to make what we say about it comprehensible, we will simplify the actual problems people face. Just take our word for it that things are really even harder than we are letting on. The first question investors face is this: how much risk to take? As a rule, riskier investments such as stocks, also called equities, earn higher rates of return than safer investments such as government bonds or money market accounts. Choosing the appropriate mix of stocks and bonds, and possibly other assets such as real estate, is called the asset allocation decision. If an investor is willing to allocate more of her money to risky assets, then she will usually make more money, but of course more risk means taking the chance that returns will actually be lower. And a decision of how much to save is related in complex ways to the willingness to bear risk. Someone who insists on investing everything in a safe money market account that earns a modest rate of interest had better be saving quite a bit if she wants to have enough to have a comfortable retirement. Suppose an investor chooses to invest 70% of her money in stocks and 30% in bonds. That choice still leaves open many specific questions of how the money is to be invested. In retirement accounts, most investors do not choose stocks individually but rather invest via mutual funds. The funds themselves differ in how risky they are and how much they charge for their services. Some funds are specialized, investing only in companies in a particular industry or country, for example, while others invest broadly. There are also funds designed for one-stop shopping, blending a mix of stocks and bonds together. Should investors form their own blend or choose a fund blended for them? Further complicating the mix is that some companies offer employees the opportunity to invest in the company's own shares. Should workers want to own shares in the company they work for? Making all of these decisions is hard work, or should be if done carefully, and participants might be excused for thinking that having made these choices they can relax and look forward to a wonderful retirement. However, all these decisions should be revisited periodically. An investor who chose to invest half her money in stocks and half in bonds could find that stocks have shot up and two-thirds of her portfolio is now invested in stocks. Should something be done? Should some of the stocks be sold to get back to the 50-50 allocation, or should she put more of her money in stocks because they seem to be doing so well? Econs have no trouble with all of these decisions, but humans can easily become flummoxed. As we will see, human investors are making all kinds of mistakes in this domain and could benefit from a more helpful and forgiving investment choice architecture. Stocks and bonds. How should you decide how much of your portfolio should be invested in stocks? Do you know how much of your portfolio is invested in stocks? Of course you know that stocks have historically earned higher rates of return, but by how much? Consider the 80-year period from 1925 to 2005. If you had invested a dollar in U.S. Treasury bills, short-term, completely safe, bonds issued by the government, you would have turned your dollar into $18, a 3.7% rate of return per year. That does not seem bad until you realize that just to keep up with inflation you had to earn 3% per year. If you had invested your money in longer-term bonds, your dollar would have become $71, a 5.5% rate of return, which is quite a bit better. But if you had invested in mutual funds that held shares in the largest American companies, such as an S&P 500 index fund, your dollar would have grown to $2,658, a 10.4% rate of return. And if you had invested in a broad portfolio of the stocks of smaller companies, you could have earned even more. In economics jargon, in which stocks are referred to as equities, the difference in the returns between treasury bills and equities is called the equity premium. This premium is considered to be compensation for the greater risk associated with investing in stocks. Whereas treasury bills are guaranteed by the federal government and are essentially risk-free, investments in stocks are risky. Although the average rate of return has been 10%, there have been years when stocks have fallen by more than 30%, and on October 19, 1987, stock indexes fell 20% or more all around the world in a single day. How would econs decide how much of their portfolio to invest in stocks? An econ would make a trade-off between risk and return that would be based on his preferences about retirement income. That is, he would decide whether the possibility of being, say, 25% richer is worth the risk of being 15% poorer. Needless to say, even if it occurred to humans to think about the problem this way, they would not know how to make the necessary calculations. The decisions they do make will differ from those of econs in two ways. First, they will be unduly influenced by short-term fluctuations, and second, their decisions are likely to be based on rules of thumb. Let's consider each in turn. Counting your money while sitting at the table. Recall from Chapter 1 that humans are loss-averse. Roughly speaking, they hate losses about twice as much as they like gains. With this in mind, consider the behavior of two investors, Vince and Rip. Vince is a stockbroker, and he has constant access to information about the value of all of his investments. By habit, at the end of each day, he runs a little program to calculate how much money he has made or lost that day. Being human, when Vince loses $5,000 in a day, he is miserable, about as miserable as he is happy at the end of a day when he gains $10,000. How does Vince feel about investing in stocks? Very nervous. On a daily basis, stocks go down about as often as they go up. So if you are feeling the pain of losses much more acutely than the pleasure of gains, you will hate investing in stocks. Now compare Vince with his friend and client, Rip, a scion of the old Van Winkle family. In a visit to his doctor, Rip is told that he is about to follow the long-standing family tradition and will soon go to sleep for 20 years. The doctor tells him to make sure he has a comfortable bed and suggests that Rip call his broker to make sure his asset allocation is where it should be. How will Rip feel about investing in stocks? Quite calm. Over a 20-year period, stocks are almost certain to go up. There is no 20-year period in history in which stocks have declined in real value or have been outperformed by bonds. So Rip calls Vince, tells him to put all his money in stocks, and sleeps like a baby. The lesson from the story of Vince and Rip is that attitudes toward risk depends on the frequency with which investors monitor their portfolios. As Kenny Rogers advises in his famous song, The Gambler, you never count your money while you're sitting at the table. There'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done. Many investors do not heed this good advice and invest too little of their money in stocks. We believe this qualifies as a mistake, because if the investors are shown the evidence of the risks of stocks and bonds over a long period of time, such as 20 years, the relevant horizon for many investors, they choose to invest nearly all of their money in stocks. Market timing. Buy high, sell low. Throughout the 1990s, people were increasing the proportion of their retirement money invested in stocks, both in terms of the percentage of money contributed each year and the account balances held. What produced this shift in behavior? One, rather remote, possibility was that investors had spent the decade poring over finance and economics journals, had learned that stock returns had been substantially higher than bond returns over the past century or so, and so decided to invest more in stocks. The other, considerably more likely, possibility is that investors have come to believe that stocks only go up, or that even if stock prices fall, that is just another buying opportunity because they quickly rise again. The stock market provided an opportunity to test these competing hypotheses during the 2000-2002 market turndown. One way to analyze the market timing ability of investors is to see how their asset allocation decisions, that is, the proportion of their portfolios invested in stocks, changed over time. The problem with this approach is that, as we have already mentioned, most people hardly ever change their portfolios unless they change jobs and have to fill out a new set of forms. So a better way to judge what people are thinking is to look at the percentage of money being invested in stocks by new participants who have just made the decision. We have data on one large group of such participants who were customers of plans administered by the Vanguard Mutual Fund Company. In 1992, new participants were allocating 58% of their assets to equities, and by 2000 that percentage had risen to 74%. In the next 2 years, however, the allocation to equities for new participants fell back to 54%. Their market timing was backward. They were heavily buying stocks when stock prices were high, and then selling stocks when their prices were low. We observe similar behavior in the asset allocations within equities. Some plans allow investors to choose funds that specialize in particular industries or sectors. We have data from one such plan that offered its employees the option of investing in a technology fund. In 1998, in the early phase of the rapid run-up in the shares of technology companies, only 12% of the employees invested in the technology fund. By 2000, when technology prices were peaking, 37% of employees had money invested in that fund. After the fall in these share prices, the number of new participants investing in the technology fund had dropped back down to 18% by 2001. Again, participants were buying into the technology fund most aggressively at the peak and selling after prices had fallen. Rules of thumb. Even the most sophisticated investors can sometimes find the decision about how to invest their money daunting, and they resort to simple rules of thumb. Take the example of the financial economist and Nobel laureate Harry Markowitz, one of the founders of modern portfolio theory. When asked about how he allocated his retirement account, he confessed, "I should have computed the historic covariances of the asset classes and drawn an efficient frontier. Instead, I split my contributions 50-50 between bonds and equities." Markowitz was not alone. In the mid-1980s, most educators had a defined contribution pension plan provided by a company that goes by its initials, TIAA CREF. At that time, the plan had only two options, TIAA, which invests in fixed income securities such as bonds, and CREF, which invests mostly in stocks. More than half of the participants in this plan, many of them professors of some sort, selected exactly a 50-50 split between these two options. One of these 50-50 investors was Sunstein. Notwithstanding his long-standing friendship with Thaler, who many years ago told him that over the long haul CREF was a better bet than TIAA, he hasn't changed a thing. It's on his list of things to do, right after canceling those magazine subscriptions. Of course, an even split between stocks and bonds is not a self-evidently dumb portfolio, but if the initial allocation is never changed, or rebalanced in the finance parlance, then over time the mix of assets will depend on the rates of return. For example, Sunstein has been investing equal amounts into TIAA and CREF for more than 25 years, and he now has well over 60% of his money in CREF. The reason is that stocks have significantly outperformed bonds over the time period he has been a professor. If he had invested most of his money in stocks, he would have done a lot better. Markowitz's strategy can be viewed as one example of what might be called the diversification heuristic. When in doubt, diversify. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. In general, diversification is a great idea, but there is a big difference between sensible diversification and the naive kind. A special case of this rule of thumb is what might be called the 1 over N heuristic. When faced with N options, divide assets evenly across the options. Put the same number of eggs in each basket. Naive diversification apparently starts young. Consider the following clever experiment conducted by Daniel Reed and George Lowenstein on Halloween night. The subjects were trick-or-treaters. In one condition, the children approached two adjacent houses and were offered a choice between the same two candy bars, Three Musketeers and Milky Way, at each house. In the other condition, they approached a single house where they were asked to choose whichever two candy bars you like. Large piles of both candies were displayed to ensure that the children would not think it was rude to take two of the same. The two conditions produced quite different results. In the house with both kinds of candy, every child selected one of each candy. In contrast, only 48% of the children picked one of each candy when they were choosing in sequence in two houses. Although the consequences of picking two different candies are minimal, Three Musketeers and Milky Way are both pretty good. Naive diversification in portfolio selection can have more significant consequences on what people do and on how much money they end up having. In a revealing study, university employees were asked how they would invest their retirement money if they had just two funds to choose from. In one condition, one of the funds invested entirely in stocks, the other in bonds. Most of the participants chose to invest their money half and half, achieving an asset allocation of 50% stocks. Another group was told that one fund invested entirely in stocks and the other balanced fund invested half in stocks and half in funds. People in this group could have also invested 50% of their money in stocks by putting all of their money in the balanced fund. Instead, they followed the 1 over N rule and divided their money evenly between the two funds, ending up with mostly stocks. People in a third group were given a choice between a balanced fund and a bond fund. Well, you can guess what they did. The result implies that the set of funds offered in a particular plan can greatly influence the choices participants make. To test this prediction, Benarzi and Thaler, 2001, examined the behavior in retirement savings plans of 170 companies. They found that the more stock funds the plan offered, the greater was the percentage of participants' money invested in stocks. Many plans have attempted to help participants deal with the difficult problem of portfolio construction by offering lifestyle funds that blend stocks and bonds in a way designed to meet the needs of different levels of risk tolerance. For example, an employer might offer three lifestyle funds: conservative, moderate, and aggressive. These funds are already diversified, so individuals need pick only the fund that fits their risk preference. Some funds also adjust the asset allocation with the age of the participant. Such a fund assortment is a good idea and represents an excellent set of default options if the fees are reasonable. But when the funds are just included in a mix of other funds, many people appear not to understand how to use them. For example, few participants put all of their money into one of these funds, even though that is the mission for which they were designed. This is the equivalent of a not particularly hungry diner going to a restaurant that offers a set 5-course menu and ordering the set menu plus the roast duck and a dessert. One study investigated the behavior of participants in a plan that offered 3 lifestyle funds and 6 other funds, an index fund, a growth fund, a bond fund, and so on. Curiously, the participants who invested in the conservative lifestyle fund allocated just 31% to that fund, dividing the rest among the other funds. Because the menu of other funds is dominated by stock funds, the resulting stock exposure for those investing in the conservative fund was 77%. These participants ended up with a fairly aggressive portfolio, probably without being aware of it. Company stock. Consider the case of Charlie Crestwood, who spent his best years in the Texas energy business. He started at the bottom in 1967. Sweeping sidewalks and emptying trash cans for a company called Houston Natural Gas. He was still there in 1985 when the company's CEO, a Houston native named Kenneth Lay, engineered its sale to a Nebraska-based competitor called InterNorth. Lay helped restructure the new company, Enron, which distributed electricity and gas throughout the United States. "My job on the pipeline was keeping the gas flowing to our customers," says Prestwood. "I worked all my life devoted to it." Life as an Enron employee was good. Prestwood's annual salary rose steadily to $65,000, with additional retirement benefits paid in Enron stock. When Houston Natural and InterNorth had merged, all of Prestwood's investments were automatically converted to Enron stock. He continued to set aside money in the company's retirement fund, buying even more stock. Internally, the company relentlessly promoted employee stock ownership. Newsletters touted Enron's growth as simply stunning, and Lay, at company events, urged employees to buy more stock. To Prestwood, it didn't seem like a problem that his future was tied directly to Enron's. Enron had committed to him, and he was showing his gratitude. "To me, this is the American way, loyalty to your employer," he says. Prestwood was loyal to the bitter end. When he retired in 2000, he had accumulated 13,500 shares of Enron stock worth $1.3 million at their peak. Then, at age 68, Prestwood suddenly lost his entire Enron nest egg. He now survives on a previous employer's pension of $521 a month and a Social Security check of $1,294. "There ain't no such thing as a dream anymore," he says. He lives on a 3-acre farm north of Houston, willed to him as a baby in 1938 after his mother died. "I hadn't planned much for the retirement. Wanted to go fishing, hunting. I was going to travel a little." Now he'll sell his family land. Has to, he says. He is still paying off his mortgage. In some respects, Prestwood's case is not unusual. Often people do not diversify at all, and sometimes employees invest a lot of their money in their employer stock. Amazing but true, 5 million Americans have more than 60% of their retirement savings in company stock. This concentration is risky on two counts. First, a single security is much riskier than the portfolios offered by mutual funds. Second, as employees of Enron and WorldCom discovered the hard way, workers risk losing both their jobs and the bulk of their retirement savings all at once. Remarkably, many employees still do not think these risks apply to their own employer. There are three problems here. First, employees do not seem to understand the risk and return profile of company stock. When the Boston Research Group surveyed 401k participants in 2002, it found that despite a high level of awareness of the Enron experience, half of the respondents thought that their own company stock carried the same or less risk than a money market fund. Another recent survey found that only a third of the respondents who owned company stock realized that it is riskier than a diversified fund with many different stocks. Second, plan participants tend to extrapolate past performance into the future. Employees of companies whose stock has been performing well over the previous 10 years tend to invest much more in company stock than employees at firms that were performing poorly. But this past performance is no prediction of the future. You might think that employees have especially good information about their firm's future prospects, but a careful study by Shlomo Benarzi, 2001, finds otherwise. Specifically, there is no correlation between the allocation of company stock and subsequent stock performance. So workers at firms such as Enron, whose stock had been flying high, kept pouring more of their money into the company's stock, with encouragement from management, right up until the day the company imploded and the stock became worthless. Third, employees who receive an employer's matching contribution in company stock view that contribution as implicit advice. In particular, those who are required to take the employer's match in the form of company stock allocate 29% of their discretionary contributions, that is, the money they have control over, to company stock. By contrast, those who have the option, but not the requirement, to take the employer's match in the form of company stock allocate only 18% of their own funds in company stock. How risky is it to hold the shares of a single stock rather than a diversified portfolio? According to estimates by the economist Lisa Melbrook, 2002, a dollar in company stock is worth less than half the value of a dollar in a mutual fund. In other words, when firms foist company stock onto their employees, it is like paying them 50 cents on the dollar. The upshot is that, in general, workers would be much better off with a diversified mutual fund than with company stock. Hint: if you have more than 10% of your retirement money invested in the company you work for, diversify as quickly as possible. What nudges can help with this problem? We prefer libertarian approaches, but we must acknowledge that a non-libertarian argument can be made for limiting the percentage of an employee's retirement portfolio that is held in company stock, say, to 10%. Bills to this effect have been introduced in Congress. A more libertarian alternative is to treat company stock like any other investment in a 401k plan. Company stock in defined contribution plans now enjoys an important benefit under the principal federal fiduciary law, an extremely important and largely unintelligible statute named the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974, ERISA. ERISA sets forth three fiduciary principles for retirement plan investments. The exclusive benefit rule, requiring that plans be managed exclusively for the benefit of participants. The prudence rule, requiring that plan assets be invested according to a prudent investor standard. And the diversification rule, requiring that plan assets be diversified so as to minimize the risk of large losses. Most notably, company stock is exempted from the diversification requirement in defined contribution plans, largely because, at the time ERISA was passed, large employers with profit-sharing plans lobbied Congress to exempt them from the diversification requirements imposed on defined benefit plans. Employers are still expected to act prudently, however, in determining whether company stock is a suitable investment. Why did Congress give preferred standing to company stock? No sensible definition of prudence can accommodate a concentrated position in a single stock, especially if that stock's performance is correlated with participants' work earnings. By giving company stock this odd preferential treatment, existing law actually encourages the inclusion of company stock in 401k plans. From the standpoint of workers' welfare, this is perverse. A natural alternative would be to treat company stock just like any other investment, without any kind of preference. This simple change might, in and of itself, solve the problem because firms might conclude that the fiduciary risk of giving large amounts of company stock to employees is not worth bearing. In the absence of a change in the law, public-spirited firms can take some steps themselves to nudge employees to reduce exceptionally large holdings of company stock. Here is an approach that will now be familiar: sell more tomorrow. The idea is to solve two problems. First, even if firms recognize that company stock is not so great for employees, they do not want all or most employees to sell their stock at once, for fear that such sales would lower the stock's price. Second, firms do not want to be signaling that they think their stock is a bad investment. The Sell More Tomorrow plan gives employees the option to sell off their shares gradually over a period of time, say 3 years, with the proceeds directed into a diversified portfolio. The program could be done on either an opt-in or opt-out basis. Nudges. Through better choice architecture, plans can help their participants on many dimensions. Attention to choice architecture has become increasingly important over the years because plans have greatly increased the number of options they offer, making it even harder for people to choose well. Defaults. Historically, most defined contribution plans did not have a default option. Participants who joined the plan would be given a list of options with the instructions to allocate their money as they wished among the funds offered. No default option was necessary until plans began to adopt automatic enrollment, a regime that requires a default. If participants are enrolled automatically, they have to be enrolled into some specific asset allocation. Traditionally, firms have selected their most conservative investment options as the default, usually a money market account. Most specialists consider a 100% allocation to a money market account to be much too conservative. The combination of the low rates of return earned in these funds, barely above inflation, and the low savings rates by many employees is simply a recipe for being poor when you get old. Firms chose this option not because they thought it was smart, but because they were worried about getting sued if they defaulted employees into something more sensible, but riskier. This fear was exacerbated by the reluctance of the Department of Labor to issue guidelines officially blessing, by granting a safe harbor status, any fund that could ever decline in value. The Department of Labor has finally issued new guidelines that are quite sensible, so the legal impediment to choosing a good default fund should no longer exist. Many good default options are available. One alternative is to offer a set of model portfolios that have varying degrees of risk. We have noted that some plan sponsors offer conservative, moderate, and aggressive lifestyle portfolios. All a participant needs to do is select the lifestyle fund that best fits his risk preferences. Another option available to plan sponsors is to offer plan participants target maturity funds. Target maturity funds typically have a year in their name, like 2010, 2030, or 2040. A participant simply selects the fund that matches their expected retirement date. Managers of the target maturity funds select the degree of risk and gradually shift the allocation away from stocks and toward conservative investments as the target date approaches. Some vendors and plan sponsors have started to offer automated solutions for portfolio selection. In particular, some plan sponsors automatically assign participants to a target maturity fund based on a standard retirement age. Others are defaulting participants into managed accounts, which are typically portfolios of stocks and bonds whose allocations are based on the age of the participants and possibly other information. Structuring complex choices. A 401k plan is an excellent domain in which to offer a process for making decisions that fit the needs of participants who have various levels of interest and sophistication. Here is an outline of a promising approach. New enrollees would be told that if they do not want to select their own investment plan, they can choose the default fund that has been selected with some care by knowledgeable experts. This might be the managed account discussed above. Participants who want to be somewhat more involved would be offered a choice among a small set of balanced or life cycle funds, with the intention that each participant would invest all her money in a single fund. For those who wanted to get really involved, a full menu of mutual funds would be offered, allowing sophisticated investors, or those who believe themselves to be sophisticated, the ability to invest as exotically as they choose. Many firms are starting to implement plans much like this. Expect error. To help those who would not get it together to join, we encourage automatic enrollment, which we would combine with Save More Tomorrow to help people achieve an adequate savings rate. For those who did not invest in a life cycle fund, we would recommend offering an automatic rebalancing plan so that a participant's asset allocation would be adjusted over time. Mappings and feedback. Most employees have difficulty understanding how numbers like savings rates, expected rates of return, and volatility translate into changes in their lifestyle when they are old. These abstract concepts can be brought into focus by offering translations into concepts anyone can understand. For example, one might create pictures of various housing options that would be available with alternative levels of retirement income. For the lowest outcome, the participant would be shown a very small, possibly run-down apartment. For higher outcomes, larger homes with swimming pools. These visual displays could be incorporated into regular feedback to participants about how they are doing in reaching their retirement savings goals. So a participant could be told in his annual report that he is currently headed for the hovel, but if he increases his savings rate now, or joins Save More Tomorrow, he could still get to the two-bedroom condo. Incentives. The primary incentive problems in this context are possible conflicts of interest between the employer and the employee. The issues regarding company stock are a good example. The ERISA laws already require firms to act in the best interest of the employees. These laws should be enforced. Forming and managing an investment portfolio over a long period of years is difficult. Most firms ask a team of internal experts, helped by outside consultants, to perform this task for the assets they manage. But individual participants typically undertake this task on their own, or with the help of a coworker or relative who may have intuition but lack training for the job. The end result is similar to what might be expected if most of us tried to cut our own hair. A mess. Most people need some help. Good choice architecture and carefully selected nudges can go a long way. Chapter 8. Credit Markets. As we mentioned in Chapter 6, Americans are now borrowing more than they are saving, and it should not be surprising to learn that human consumers are not any more sophisticated about their borrowing than they are about their investing. Consider Homer Simpson's experience when leasing a recreational vehicle called a Canyonero. Canyonero salesman. Okay, Here's how your lease breaks down. This is your down payment, then here's your monthly, and there's your weekly. Homer.
That's it, right?
Salesman. Yep. Oh, then after your final monthly payment, there's the routine CBP, or crippling balloon payment. Homer.
But that's not for a while, right?
Salesman. Right. Homer.
Sweet.
Homer's naivety is less unusual and more revealing than it might seem. Let's examine three important leading markets, mortgages, student loans, and credit cards, to see whether some nudges might help the many Homers among us. Mortgages. Once upon a time, shopping for a mortgage was pretty easy. Most mortgages had a fixed rate for the life of the mortgage, typically 30 years. Most borrowers provided a 20% down payment. In this regime, comparing loans was a snap. Just pick the loan with the lowest interest rate. This task was made especially easy with the passage of the Choice-Friendly Truth in Lending Act, also known as Regulation Z, which required all lenders to report interest rates the same way, using what is called the Annual Percentage Rate, APR. At the time, the Truth in Lending Act was an excellent bit of choice architecture because it made it easy to compare loans. In the absence of a simple way, such as APR, to judge loans, evaluating various mortgage options is quite difficult. A study by Suzanne Hsu, 2007, finds that even MBA students at the top school had difficulty picking out the best loans, and this was in a task that was much simpler than the one they would encounter in the real world. Mortgage shopping has now become much more complicated. Borrowers can choose from a variety of fixed-rate loans, for which the interest rate does not change over the life of the loan, and also numerous variable-rate loans in which the interest rate goes up and down according to movements in the market. Borrowers might also consider such exotic products as interest-only loans, under which the borrower makes no payments toward the principal on the loan, meaning that it is never paid off unless the house is sold, with luck, at a profit, or the borrower either wins the lottery or refinances the loan. Many variable-rate mortgages are further complicated by so-called teaser rates. The low interest rate applies for a period of a year or two, after which the rate, and payments, go up, sometimes dramatically. Then there is the matter of fees, which can vary greatly. Points, which are fixed payments the borrower makes in order to receive a lower interest rate, and prepayment penalties that must be paid if the loan is repaid early. In this world, choosing a mortgage makes picking a retirement portfolio look easy, and the stakes are just as big. Here as elsewhere, the addition of more options has the potential to make people better off, but this potential is realized only if they are able to do a good job of picking the loan that is best suited to their situation and preferences. How do people do in shopping for mortgages? A study by the economist Susan Woodward, 2007, examined more than 7,000 loans insured by the Federal Housing Administration, FHA. A government agency that insures smaller loans and allows low down payments. Woodward studied which kinds of borrowers got the best deals and under what circumstances, after controlling for risk and other factors. Here are some of her key findings. African American borrowers pay an additional $425 for their loans. Latino borrowers pay an additional $400. The average fee for all borrowers was $3,133. On loans that averaged about $105,000. Borrowers who live in neighborhoods where adults have only a high school education pay $1,160 more for their loans than borrowers who live in neighborhoods where adults have a college education. Loans made by mortgage brokers are more expensive than those made by direct lenders by about $600. Sources of loan complexity, such as points and seller contributions to closing costs, which can make comparing loans more difficult, are expensive for borrowers, and the additional cost is greater on brokered loans than on direct loans. We can take some general lessons from this analysis. When markets get more complicated, unsophisticated and uneducated shoppers will be especially disadvantaged by the complexity. The unsophisticated shoppers are also more likely to be given bad or self-interested advice by people serving in roles that appear to be helpful and purely advisory. In this market, mortgage brokers who cater to rich clients probably have a greater incentive to establish a reputation for fair dealing. By contrast, mortgage brokers who cater to the poor are often more interested in making a quick buck. These factors are exacerbated in the segment of the market that caters to the poorest and highest risk borrowers, the so-called subprime market. As is often the case, there are two extreme views about subprime loans. Some, particularly those left of center or in the news media, label all such loans with a derogatory term, predatory. This broad brush fails to recognize the obvious fact that higher risk loans will have to have higher interest rates to compensate for the people who lend the money. The fact that poor and risky borrowers pay higher interest rates does not make these loans predatory. In fact, the microfinance loans in developing countries that led to a well-deserved Nobel Peace Prize for Muhammad Yunus in 2006 often come with interest rates of 200% or more, yet the borrowers are made better off by these loans. On the other side, some observers think that the hue and cry about predatory lending is based entirely on the failure of left-leaning journalists and others to understand that risky loans require higher interest rates. As usual, the truth lies somewhere between the two extremes. Subprime lending is neither all good nor all bad. The good feature of subprime lending is that it offers credit to those who could not otherwise borrow and makes it possible for some poor or high-risk families to become homeowners or business owners. Subprime loans also give people a valuable second chance. Subprime lenders provide funding for any large purchase. More often than not, these purchases help people achieve an American dream, better home ownership. In fact, the vast majority of subprime loans are either refinanced mortgages or home equity loans. In what sense, then, are subprime loans really predatory? Subprime borrowers are often unsophisticated, and they are sometimes exploited by the brokers. A front-page story in the Wall Street Journal described in some detail the behavior of one such broker, Altaf Sheikh, a one-time professional cricket player turned pushy mortgage lender. Sheikh, who jumped from one mortgage company to another, made a long series of loans that greatly profited him but were generally less beneficial to his customers. For the type of borrowers Sheikh offered, here is the typical pattern. The borrowers are approached by the broker, who acts like he is doing him a favor, and so they may not do much shopping. Solicitation can be in person or via mail or nearly any other medium. For example, a home improvement contractor might stop by a house to suggest a renovation and then conveniently refer the residents to a mortgage broker. At the follow-up meeting, the broker suggests different mortgages to the prospective borrower. Here the borrower can choose the interest rate, monthly payment, and number of points she wants to pay. This last choice is particularly confusing. Points allow borrowers to pay a fee, an amount that is added to the loan because the borrower typically borrows money to pay for the points, in exchange for a lower interest rate, but few borrowers are capable of figuring out whether the points are worth paying. Hint: usually they are not. Once the borrower agrees to a particular mortgage, the law requires that a good faith estimate is presented, spelling out all the costs of the loan, including the fee paid to the broker. Although this estimate must be shown to the borrower within 3 days of the initial application, it is sometimes withheld until right before the borrower signs the mortgage. At that point, the estimate will be part of a huge pile of papers that are more often shuffled than read. This defeats the whole purpose of the estimate. The same problem occurs at closing. The broker brings a stack of papers for the borrower to look through and sign. Even though these forms describe the terms and conditions of the mortgage, signing the paperwork is a formality for most people. At such a late stage, most borrowers are not in any position to rethink, or for that matter, think. Ironically, part of this problem was brought on by good intentions. The Truth in Lending Act was originally intended to summarize the terms of the loan in clear terms. But it is hard to see truth when it is buried in a mountain of fine print. For high-risk loans, a Home Ownership and Equity Protection Act disclosure is supposed to give extra warning to the borrower, but the disclosure form doesn't explicitly say high-risk, and the borrower simply needs to sign the form. As anyone who has ever bought a house knows, there are many forms to sign, and buyers often just start signing without doing much reading. Other confusing forms make it difficult for a borrower to distinguish between the loan itself and the fees involved. Mortgage forms have hundreds of lines, and the numbers that clutter the form can obscure various charges. Many of the fees aren't defined. Some borrowers do not know that they will be charged more if they pay off the mortgage ahead of time. That is, they will face a prepayment penalty. And it doesn't help that most subprime loans have variable rates that further complicate the problem of understanding the transaction. In 2007, there was an eruption of subprime foreclosures, which caused ripples throughout financial markets, prompting many government bodies to think harder about how to help. Of course, markets, left alone, will solve some of the problem, because investors who had been buying up subprime loans learned the hard way that the loans were riskier than they seemed. In many ways, the mortgage brokers were deceiving the investors who bought up the loans as well as the people who borrowed the money. But market forces did not prevent the problem from occurring, so there have been calls for more intervention. Some demand an end to predatory lending, but because loans do not come stamped predatory, it is hard to implement any such ban without depriving many deserving but high-risk borrowers from any source of financing. And of course, we libertarian paternalists do not favor bans. Instead, we prefer an improvement in choice architecture that will help people make better choices and avoid loans that really are predatory, loans that exploit people's ignorance, confusion, and vulnerability. In fact, we think that the entire mortgage market could benefit from a major upgrade in choice architecture. The basic problem is that the old Truth in Lending Act is now hopelessly inadequate. When interest rates vary and there are myriad fees to pay, just looking at the APR is far from enough. The law professor Lauren Wilkins, 2006, suggests one strategy for reform, which is to limit the set of permissible mortgages in order to make comparison easier. This would involve banning mortgages with such features as negative amortization or balloon payments. In these mortgages, large payments are due at the end because the mortgage and interest have not been fully paid over the term. The idea is that if there are fewer types of mortgages, for example, only 30-year fixed-rate loans, then borrowers would have an easier time choosing wisely. Wilkins thinks that the costs of these exotic mortgages outweigh the benefits. Wilkins also proposes that the loan estimate must remain valid for 30 days and that the borrower must wait before purchasing a loan. Although we see some merit in this proposal and are sympathetic with the goal of making shopping easier, Wilkins's proposal does not qualify as libertarian paternalism because it prohibits contracts that may be mutually beneficial. Variable rate mortgages, even with teaser rates, are not inherently bad. For those who are planning to sell their house or refinance within a few years, these mortgages can be highly attractive. Instead, we think that a version of our recap plan can help. We have in mind two versions of recap in this domain. In the simplified form, mortgage lenders would be required to report lending costs in two categories, fees and interest. In a version of such a report suggested by Wilkins, all the different types of fees would be reported, but they would be added up into a single salient number. Woodward's research finds that the people who get the best deals, by a lot, are those who pay no fee up front. This just means that the broker pays all the fees out of his commission. There may be occasional free lunches, but there is no such thing as a free mortgage. The likely explanation for this result is that when the fee is zero, it is simpler for borrowers to compare terms, because the interest rate is the only thing they have to look at. The interest rate disclosure would include the rate, of course, but also a schedule of payments over a period of years, assuming that the underlying interest rates do not change. This would ensure that borrowers at least know what their payments will be when the teaser rate ends. It would be a good idea to add some kind of worst-case scenario information so that borrowers can see how much their payments could go up in the future. Lenders would also have to provide a machine-readable detailed recap report, one that incorporates all the fees and interest rate provisions, including teaser rates, what the variable rate changes are linked to, caps on the changes per year, and so forth. This information would allow independent third parties to offer much better advice. Our strong hunch is that if the recap data were made available, third-party services would emerge to compare lenders. Care would need to be taken that the system did not foster collusion, but we think this would be easy enough to monitor and prevent. Recap data would thus make it easier to shop for mortgages online, which should make the mortgage market more competitive. Online shopping is especially likely to help women and minority groups. A study of automobile shopping found that women and African Americans pay about the same amount as white males when they buy a car online, but at the dealership they pay more, even after you account for other factors, such as income. Student loans. The cost of going to college has been rising almost as fast as the cost of health care and rare baseball cards. At many private universities, including ours, it costs a student more than $50,000 a year in tuition, room, and board. Scholarships and part-time jobs typically do not cover the cost of college. So students and their families often turn to student loans to help out. In fact, loans are a common option. About two-thirds of four-year college students are in debt when they graduate. There are two kinds of loans in the marketplace: purely private loans given by financial institutions, and loans that are backed by the federal government, so-called Stafford loans. These Stafford loans are need-based. The government pays the interest on the loans while the student is in school, guarantees payment to the lender if the student defaults, and subsidizes the loans. Lenders find making these loans highly profitable. Unfortunately, student borrowers and their families face the same kind of difficulties as subprime borrowers. Similarly, misleading mail solicitations come from private lenders aimed at a younger audience. Some of these solicitations are hilarious in their absurdity, but apparently they are effective too. For example, one of the dozens of loan flyers that our student intern received in the mail during his senior year of high school suggested that getting a loan of $40,000 could be as easy as ordering a pizza, and pictured a pizza chef promising a decision delivered within 15 minutes. Shopping for a student loan is nearly as complicated as looking for a mortgage. Students typically try for a federal loan because they are cheaper, a fact not mentioned by the pizza man in the ad, then look at private loans if necessary. To apply for a federal loan, a student must first fill out the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, FAFSA. If the student has also applied for financial aid at a private college, she must also complete the College Board's financial aid profile. Each form contains more than 100 questions that vary according to the schools involved, and filling one out takes many hours. Some high school and college students joke that it takes longer than the college application itself. Like a typical mortgage form, the scale of these questionnaires is overwhelming. Students are asked to answer questions about their parents' finances, even if they don't know much about them. After the forms have been filled out, the Department of Education determines how much the student's family can pay for college, called the Expected Family Contribution. From there, the college decides on the size of the loan. Alternatively, the student can go to the private sector for a loan. By sending proof of college enrollment to the lender, a student can receive as much money as she thinks is necessary. Unlike federal loans, this money can be used for any expenses, so direct-to-consumer loans could potentially encourage students to borrow too much and to overspend. As in the case of mortgages, when a borrower often naively asks advice from his mortgage broker, students and their parents have traditionally turned to their college's financial aid offices for advice. Of course, most such offices are helpful and honest. Alas, some of them have been no more scrupulous than the cricket player turned mortgage broker. The loan officers offer advice all right, but instead of a well-intentioned nudge, the advice has often been a self-serving shove. Some colleges' financial aid offices have tag-teamed with lenders who have provided gifts, stock options, and donations to the college in order to become preferred lenders, a kind of good housekeeping stamp for student loans. Occasionally, a college's financial aid staff tells students that they may choose only lenders on a preferred list, even if these lenders don't necessarily provide loans in the best interest of the student. At one university, a lender was allowed to provide staff for a call center under a college's name. When students called in to ask about loans, those unbiased employees pushed their own company's loans. When the students took out these loans, the lender kindly shared profits with the college. One might wonder why lenders are so eager to get the student loan business that they are willing to engage in practices that are at least sleazy and possibly illegal. The answer is that the combination of loan guarantee and subsidy by the government makes these loans exceptionally profitable, so lenders compete hard to get the business. Presumably, it was the hope of such competition that led the government to design the program in this partially privatized manner, in which the federal government hands out subsidies but relies on the private sector to distribute the loans. However, the competition has not focused on price. Instead, the lenders have engaged in what economists call rent-seeking activities. The idea is that if there are high profits to be made, suppliers will be willing to spend a lot of time and money to get that business. Because excess profits are available to the lenders who snag the student loan business, there are temptations to do whatever it takes to get to the head of the line. As with mortgages, this example illustrates the problem with directing people to seek expert advice when they face difficult, high-stakes problems and are confused about what to do. If they don't just reply to the pizza ad because it is easy, but instead try to get helpful advice, they may end up with suggestions that are as self-serving as the pizza man's. The advisor they consult has a treasure: confused customers. The opportunity to fleece confused customers is valuable. There is money on the table. It is difficult to design public policies that inhibit advisors from taking that money. Better to inform the consumer by improving the choice architecture. If borrowers could compare loans more easily, then the price competition that was hoped for might actually emerge. One helpful nudge would be to simplify the financial aid application. The complicated format of these forms can discourage students from applying for financial aid and cause them to seek pricey direct-to-consumer loans instead. Although the Department of Education has not released a specific formula for how it determines how much aid a family should receive, an application of RECAP to student loans would start with cutting down the number of questions on the FAFSA and making them uniform for all loans, federal and private. The FAFSA application could also be combined with an annual tax return. In one ongoing Ohio study, tax professionals at H&R Block offer a FAFSA software package to families likely to qualify for federal or state financial aid. This software uses the tax return to complete most of the FAFSA for submission. A RECAP policy would make it much easier for students to compare various loan options offered through their school. Indeed, learning to use a student loan RECAP spreadsheet might be an excellent assignment in a high school math class for seniors. Another possibility would be to help families avoid loans altogether, or at least reduce the need for such loans, by helping them start saving for college earlier via college savings accounts, 529 plans. In research in progress by Ari Bettinger, Bridget Long, and Phil Oriopoulos, eighth graders and their parents must meet with school counselors and receive a small nudge. At the meetings, families are offered the option of directly depositing money from a checking account into a college savings account each month. As an incentive, they receive $100 in savings for signing up. Through this process, families could conveniently save money for college. Credit cards. The credit card is a ubiquitous feature of modern life. It is nearly impossible to function in society without one. Try checking into a hotel, renting a car, or renting a set of golf clubs without a credit card. Good luck. Credit cards serve two functions. First, they provide a mode of payment in lieu of cash and have largely replaced checks for that purpose in face-to-face transactions, thankfully, although occasionally you still get stuck behind someone in a grocery store checkout line who wants to write a check for a $7.37 purchase. The second purpose of a credit card is to provide a ready source of liquidity if you want to spend more than you currently have in cash. Debit cards, which look just like credit cards, serve only the first function because they are linked to a bank account and do not allow for borrowing unless linked also to a line of credit. Warning: some debit card offer lines of credit at high fees. If you use a debit card to borrow, you should make sure that the fees you pay are lower than they would be with a credit card. Credit cards are blessedly convenient. Paying with a credit card is often faster than paying with cash, and lets you avoid struggling with change, digging into your pocket to find the correct change, and managing the large jar of pennies at home are vexations from which you are liberated. Not to mention the frequent flyer miles. But if you are not careful, credit cards can be addicting. Consider these numbers. The Census Bureau reported that there are more than 1.4 billion credit cards in 2004 for 164 million cardholders, an average of 8.5